Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Monday, May 17th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. We can expect wind and rain today, high of 70 degrees, and low of 59 degrees tonight under mostly cloudy skies. When we look around the region, rather cloudy and breezy today, with a touch of rain, mostly cloudy tonight, breezy tomorrow morning, mainly cloudy with a couple of showers. Wednesday, cloudy and breezy, with a couple of showers. The next phase of the moon is going to be on the 19th, and it will be first quarter. Sun rose this morning at 5:46, and it sets tonight at 8:27 p.m. Our stories on the front page include Program Offers Aid with Rent and Utilities, Brush with Greatness, and we'll begin with Waterloo Shooting Victim ID'd. The story begins with a photograph of two police officers, and the caption says, "Police document the scene in the 1400 block of Grant Avenue, where one man died and two women were injured in a shooting early Saturday, Waterloo. Authorities have released the name of a Waterloo man who died in an early Saturday shooting. Waterloo police identified the deceased as 23-year-old Dayton Matlock. Matlock was found dead in an alley in the 1400 block of Grant Avenue around 3:30 a.m. Saturday, after several neighbors heard gunfire and called 911. Also injured in the shooting were 39-year-old Bobby Lee of Waterloo and 30-year-old Shania Hammer of Des Moines. They were taken to a local hospital with gunshot wounds that weren't life-threatening, police said. Waterloo police continue to investigate and are interviewing witnesses. Anyone with information is asked to call Waterloo Police Department at this phone number, 319-291-4340. Program Offers Aid with Rent and Utilities. Story filed by Amy Rivers. State agency receives $195 million to cover past due payments. If you rent your home, make less than 80% of the median income, and qualified for unemployment or had reduced income in the past year, you may be eligible to help with back payments for rent and utilities for the last 12 months through a state government program. Iowa Finance Authority in late March opened the Iowa Rent and Utility Assistance Program, where eligible renters can apply to make retroactive payments on debt incurred since March 13, 2020. The program was created as part of the Federal Consolidation Appropriations Act of 2021. IFA received $195 million to pay the past due bills of those in need, said Communications Director Ashley Jared. Quote, "We're really trying to help those folks dig out of a hole," she said. It's unknown how many Iowa households are behind on their rent payments. The U.S. Census estimated in a recent survey around 4.6% of households, which amounts to tens of thousands of households, were behind on rent and had little to no confidence that they can make their next payment. Around 4,000 households across the state have already applied, Jared said. At that rate, there will be plenty of money left by the deadline of September 30, 2022. Quote, "We fully expect to have funds available through that date, unless for some reason there is a large increase in applications," she said. "Those payments will be made directly to landlords and utility providers on the renter's behalf. Future obligations aren't eligible." Single people in Black Hawk County making less than $41,550 annually are eligible to apply, as are two-person households making less than $47,450 and three-person households with less than $53,400 in annual income. In Bremer County, single people must make less than $49,700, while two people must make less than $56,800. In Buchanan County, a single-person household must make less than $43,600, while duos could make less than $49,800 and still qualify. The full list of income guidelines are at iowafinance.com. Those looking to submit a claim need to provide proof of identification as well as documentation of income, financial hardships, and risk of losing their home or outstanding charges at their utility companies. They'll also have to notify their landlord, who also must fill out an application. Quote, the landlord must certify they won't evict the tenant for the months they're receiving funding for and waive all late fees and penalties, unquote, Jared said, adding that so far, quote, every landlord participating agreed to those terms. Brush with greatness. Iconic artists rub elbows with lesser knowns at University of Northern Iowa Gallery of Art. This story is filed by Melody Parker and begins with the photograph of a gentleman wearing white gloves and handling a very large painting. And the caption says, University of Northern Iowa Gallery of Art Director Daryl Taylor removes a Robert Rauschenberg lithograph titled Post Rally, edition 36 of 42, from an archive shelf on April 18th in Cedar Falls. An editor's note says, this is the second in the Treasure Trove series. Cedar Falls. It's not name-dropping to mention that the University of Northern Iowa Gallery of Art is home to works by Rembrandt, Picasso, Andy Warhol, Grant Wood, and Salvador Dali, among other iconic artists. The permanent collection also contains many significant works by others who aren't household names. In a well-organized storage area inside the gallery, director Daryl Taylor lifts the lid off a large box and peels back layers of acid-free tissue paper, swaddling what looks like, yes, it is, a brick plate. Quote, this is one of our most significant pieces. It's the only Robert Arnson in the collection, an untitled self-portrait of the California sculptor, ceramist, considered the father of funk art, said Taylor, holding up the ceramic plate that's a nod to Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. Arnson's anti-establishment movement in the late 60s and 70s at the University of California, Davis, had as its hallmarks absurdist, mocking humor, and visual puns. The brick plate was a gift to the collection, Taylor said. There are more than 4,000 artworks, including paintings, prints, ceramics, photography, sculpture, mixed media, books, drawings, 15th century illuminated manuscripts, even playing cards. The collection began in the 1930s, and the most recent acquisition is a Brooke Harker acrylic-on-ink canvas of the Eiffel Tower, a gift from a collector. In earlier days, the gallery was able to purchase pieces for the collection. Many more are gifts from donors and artists themselves. Quote, it never stops, said Taylor, who also serves as curator and has been at the gallery for about 20 years. Quote, there are at least 20 to 30 new objects added to the permanent collection every year. That makes it a very broad-based collection as well, unquote. Between 2012 and 2013, the storage space was retrofitted with mobile storage units to house the collection. Quote, and we're already running out of room for 3D objects. We have to get creative how we store things, and we have artwork on display in buildings and offices around campus, said Taylor. Most donors have a connection, no matter how tenuous, to the university, the Cedar Valley, or Iowa. Occasionally, artworks arrive in bulk. For example, a collection of 200 objects gifted by Louis Eisenminger that includes pieces by Chicago artists and a new art examiner box filled with works by 25 artists, a collection of 400 ceramics by North Carolina artists in the Seagrove pottery tradition were given to the gallery by UNI graduate Dr. Lawrence W.S. Odd of Tarboro, North Carolina. Another important work is Fancy Dress Ball, a 1929 watercolor by German expressionist George Grosz, acquired in 1959. It was recently among works undergoing conservation at Midwest Art Conservation Center in Minneapolis before being returned to storage. A Rembrandt etching underwent conservation as well. There are several Salvador Dali works in the collection, including a color intaglio homage to Quivendo, edition 193 of 240, and The Quest from the Sweet Historia de Don Quixote de la Mancha, etching and aquatint. The dollies may be the most valuable pieces in the collection, Taylor said. The gallery houses examples of modern and contemporary artwork, including abstract expressionist painter Philip Guston's painting number 6 from 1952, acquired in the 1950s for $500. English sculptor and printmaker Elizabeth Frink's lithographs and etchings, and Joseph Albers' Homage to the Square, Blue Call, an example of the artist's iconic color squares painting. There are 4 Mauricio Lasansky intaglios from the 1950s and 60s, Andy Warhol's screen print on Arches paper, quote, Ladies and Gentlemen, and lithographs by pop artist Robert Rauschenberg, known for his combines that blurred the line between sculpture and paintings. Well-known Iowa artists, including Decora's Dean Swartz of Cedar Falls' Nina Ward and Marjorie Nunn, are also represented. The UNI Gallery of Art is the exhibition and performance art venue of the UNI Department of Art, annually presenting student and faculty shows, in addition to a full calendar of exhibitions and installations. The collection also supports department curriculum and is a resource for programming. Quote, We offer students chances to work in the galleries and behind the scenes to show them the business of art, what happens at a gallery, how to get a job at a gallery, how artwork is conserved and maintained, how we lend pieces to other galleries, right down to wrapping and preparing to ship artworks, Taylor explained. The UNI Friends of the Permanent Art Collection and Gallery is undertaking a project to photograph all of the objects in the collection, which the public can help sponsor through donations. 2 dead in apparent murder-suicide in Waterloo. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Waterloo. 2 people are dead following an apparent murder-suicide in Waterloo on Saturday night. Officers were called to a report of gunfire at the Pine View Place Apartments, 3870 Pine View, around 11:05 p.m. Saturday, and found a woman with a gunshot wound. She was pronounced dead at the scene, according to police. Investigators talked to witnesses and developed a suspect. The male suspect was located a few hours later in an alley behind the 2200 block of East 4th Street. As officers began setting up a perimeter, the suspect apparently shot himself and died at the scene, according to police. Autopsies are pending, and police aren't looking for any additional suspects. The names of the victim and suspect are not being released at this time, pending notification of family. Bipartisan group pushes for more restaurant aid. Washington. Lawmakers from both parties are pushing to shore up a new relief fund for restaurants that is already on track to run out of money. Less than 2 weeks since the $28.6 billion Restaurant Revitalization Fund opened for business, demand for aid has outstripped supply. More than 266,000 restaurants have requested more than $65 billion to replenish revenue lost to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Small Business Administration reported. Officials have said they knew from the outset that more money would be needed. Initial legislation called for $120 billion, but the pandemic relief package that became law in March included only $28.6 billion. Quote, The extraordinary demand for the Restaurant Revitalization Fund shows that Congress must do more to help, Representative Earl Blumenauer, Democrat of Oregon, Representative Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican of Pennsylvania, Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, and Senator Roger Wickler, Republican from Mississippi, said in a joint statement, quote, We need to work swiftly in a bipartisan way to replenish this critical fund so that all local restaurants can access the relief required for a full recovery. The four lawmakers sponsored the original legislation to create the fund. Sinema's backing of a new round of aid could bolster prospects for passage, since the Arizona Democrat is often a swing vote in the evenly divided Senate. When the relief law passed in March, Sinema touted the support of the Arizona Restaurant Association and businesses like Tempe-based Arizona Distilling Company and Thumb Butte Distillery in Prescott, Arizona. Sinema said restaurants were responsible for 11% of Arizona jobs in 2019, before the pandemic struck. The pandemic has battered the restaurant industry, which has struggled through closures and limited capacity seating over the past year. Revenue was down by nearly $240 billion, and 2.5 million employees were out of work, based on a December survey by the National Restaurant Association. About 110,000 restaurants have permanently or temporarily closed. Since the fund opened on May 3rd, 21,000 restaurants have received a total of $2.7 billion in aid, according to the Small Business Administration, which manages the program. The Biden administration has taken steps to target much of the initial aid to smaller restaurants and those from disadvantaged backgrounds, as the pandemic relief law requires. More than 147,000 applications came from women, veterans, and socially and economically disadvantaged business owners who collectively requested $29 billion in relief, the SBA said. Quote, the numbers show that we've been particularly successful at reaching the smallest restaurants and underserved communities that have struggled to access relief, said SBA Administrator Isabella Guzman. We are making progress, but we have much more work to do as we continue reaching our underserved entrepreneurs, unquote. But the focus on disadvantaged groups, which, when fully distributed, would eat up the entire initial funding allocation for the program, has also triggered a court challenge. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a conservative legal advocacy group, filed a lawsuit Wednesday against Guzman, saying white men are being pushed to the back of the line for aid, the Associated Press reported. The restaurant grant program can be used to cover expenses incurred since February 15, 2020, lasting through March 2023. Legitimate expenses include payroll, mortgage payments, maintenance, food, supplies, and more. Grants can't exceed $5 million per business or $10 million per restaurant group. The COVID-19 aid law mandates that priority will be given to women, veteran-owned businesses, and socially and economically disadvantaged groups during the initial 21-day period for the fund is open. In addition, $5 billion of the total $28.6 billion in assistance is set aside for businesses with less than $500,000 in 2019 gross receipts, further limiting the program's availability unless Congress tops off the fund. Businesses eligible for a piece of the fund include, quote, a restaurant, food stand, food truck, food cart, caterer, saloon, inn, tavern, bar, lounge, brew pub, tasting room, tap room, licensed facility, or premise of a beverage alcohol producer where the public may taste, sample, or purchase products, or other similar place of business in which the public or patrons assemble for the primary purpose of being served food or drink, unquote. The coronavirus relief law also makes clear that the same businesses located in airport terminals or owned by tribal governments are eligible. However, a recipient can't have owned or operated more than 20 locations prior to the pandemic-related economic shutdowns last March and can't be publicly traded. Turning to the Cedar Valley page, Traveling the World with Hemingway. New Hemingway book takes UNI graduate Curtis DeBerg across the globe, story filed by Melody Parker, and begins with a photograph of Curtis DeBerg taken with the backdrop of a small creek in a lush green wooded area, Cedar Falls. Ernest Hemingway's travels are as iconic as the author himself: Paris, Havana, Pamplona, Spain, the French Riviera. With the exception of Cuba, author Curtis DeBerg visited as many Hemingway haunts as possible for his new book, Traveling the World with Hemingway. In 1979, University of Northern Iowa graduate and Rock Rapids native set out to follow Hemingway's footsteps, not as a lark, but as an odyssey, after surviving a plane crash in Poland in June 2016. Quote, "I was searching for an escape from pain and, in a way, a few of my other demons. I could get lost in Hemingway's books and his life story. It took my mind off my own problems. He was a good distraction," said DeBerg in 2019. He took a leave of absence from California State University in Chico to chase Hemingway. Hemingway's cult-like following, even among academics, intrigued DeBerg. Quote, "One Facebook group has over 30,000 members. Many of these followers are adoring fans, and they treat Hemingway as a hero, much the same way kids revere their favorite baseball player. The man has become mythological, even legendary. But I caution people to remember that he was just a man, plagued by his own demons, who was endowed with the unbelievable gift of being able to write one hell of a story," he explained. DeBerg read Hemingway's books and short stories and every scrap of paper about the man during his months of recovery from injuries suffered in the plane crash. He felt a sort of kinship with Hemingway, who himself had survived two plane crashes in Africa in 1954. Quote, "Mentally, I was struggling too, and I remembered that Hemingway had told F. Scott Fitzgerald, 'How the hell can you bleed over your own personal tragedies when you're a writer? You should welcome them, because serious writers have to be hurt really terrible before they can write seriously,'" DeBerg recalled. DeBerg met Wild River Press publisher Tom Perro, a fly fishing buddy of Hemingway's oldest son, Jack, who died in 2000. He pitched his idea for visiting Hemingway sites for a new perspective on the author's demons, and Pergo urged him to first focus on a photographic essay. The coffee table-sized Traveling the World with Hemingway incorporates new historical photos as well as narrative and 240 full-color pages. DeBerg's adventure began in Hemingway's birthplace, Oak Park, Illinois, and Petoskey, Michigan, as a child. Hemingway spent summer vacations in northern Michigan, where he learned to love the outdoors. Traveling to Europe, Paris became DeBerg's home base for the next 9 months. His expeditions took him to Switzerland, Austria, Italy, and the French Riviera. While he couldn't travel to Cuba, he hired a photographer to shoot in Havana. In some places like Paris, you can sense Hemingway's spirit almost everywhere you go. The Latin Quarter, Luxembourg Gardens, Musée d'Orsay, Harry's Bar, and the Ritz. I love walking around Paris and imagining what it must have been like over 100 years ago. Also, you can't help but feel his presence along the Piave River in Falsalta, Italy. This is where he was injured in World War I. Also, Pamplona, Spain. Everywhere you turn, there's a statue, portrait, or plaque honoring him. Interestingly, though, he never actually ran with the bulls, but he did go inside the bull ring a few times to play with the steers that had their horns blunted. He never put himself in any real danger, though. This is part of the Hemingway myth, DeBerg explained. Quote, "The most interesting thing I have learned about Hemingway is how much he let fantastic stories about him continue to be told as though they were true, when in fact he knew much of the story was false," unquote. In Madrid, DeBerg stayed at the Pension El Aguilar, in the same room Hemingway and his first wife, Hadley, shared in 1925. He intended to end his journey with visits to Montana, Wyoming, and Ketchum, Idaho, and a stop Boston's JFK Library to view the Hemingway collection. COVID-19 travel restrictions halted his return to the U.S., so he once again hired a photographer to shoot the sites, promising himself to visit when he returned stateside. Still living in Paris, DeBerg has nearly finished the manuscript for his second book, quote, "Chasing Hemingway's Demons." He expects to have it published before Christmas. Quote, "Traveling the World with Hemingway is available from the Wild River Press online booksellers and is being sold at the Hemingway House in Key West, Florida. Economic Inequality, the Focus of 24/7 Black Leadership Advancement Consortium Conference, filed by Sidney Cizon, Waterloo. Strategies to address economic inequality will be the focus of an upcoming virtual conference hosted by the 24/7 Black Leadership Advancement Consortium, according to a news release. The conference, from 9 a.m. to noon, June 18th, will feature discussions about equality in employment, wealth, and home ownership. The event aims to transform racial inequality in the Cedar Valley that was identified by the financial website 24/7 Wall Street, which listed Waterloo and Cedar Falls area as one of the country's worst sites for Black people. Speakers include Waterloo native and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, Brookings Institution Senior Fellow Andre Perry, U.S. Bank Chief Diversity Officer Greg Cunningham, All-American Meats CEO Sean Buchanan, and Loop Capital Markets CEO and CNBC contributor Courtney Gibson, according to the news release. The news release called the event extremely timely, given the disproportionate effect of the joblessness on Black and African American community in Black Hawk County during the pandemic. An analysis of state unemployment data by the Courier showed that Black and African American residents made up 17.5% of the county's unemployment claims from March 2020 through February 2021. Black residents comprise 9.7% of the county's population. Host organization 24/7 Black Leadership Advancement Consortium plans to recognize people at the conference who made contributions to its mission. 24/7 BLAC is a program for African American professionals in the Cedar Valley. The group previously hosted other financial empowerment events. Woman pleads in jail escape plot, filed by Jeff Reinitz, and begins with a photograph of Donske Rashawn Donston. Waterloo. An Ohio woman has pleaded to allegations she attempted to help her boyfriend escape from jail. Donske Rashawn Donston, 23, of Columbus, pleaded to one count of conspiracy to commit a felony Wednesday. Authorities alleged Donston and another person had plotted to assist Tyrone Lamar Copeland to flee from sheriff's deputies when he was taken to Unity Point Allen Hospital to have a toe removed in December. Quote, "We planned to help him escape by having a vehicle ready to drive him away as he was going to the hospital for outpatient surgery," Donston said in a written guilty plea. Court records allege they used the Black Hawk County Jail's video visitation system to coordinate with Donston, driving around the hospital to show Copeland the layout and describe the Land Rover they planned to leave for him. The escape wasn't successful. Deputies were tipped off and detained Donston when she pulled up at the hospital shortly before Copeland's scheduled procedure. Sentencing will be at a later date. The charge carries up to 5 years in prison, although the state will seek probation and the defense can request a deferred judgment, according to the plea agreement. In April, Copeland pleaded to a conspiracy charge in the escape attempt, and he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. He also pleaded to unrelated drug and firearm charges and was sentenced to an additional 5 years. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, May 17th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, since there are no obituaries in today's paper, we'll turn to the sports page. In women's college softball, Panthers receive at-large bid to NCAA softball tournament, filed by Jim Nelson. Cedar Falls. 5 years ago, when Northern Iowa softball coach Ryan Jacobs was recruiting Sammy Bunch, he made her a promise. Jacobs told Bunch by the time she graduated, he'd schedule a game against Missouri in Columbia, Missouri, which is about 60 minutes from Bunch's hometown of Frankenstein, Missouri. Jacobs was set to deliver on that promise last year, but was forced to pull the Panthers out of a tournament at Missouri because it didn't set up well in UNI's schedule. Sunday, Jacobs got Bunch, UNI's star shortstop, a game in Columbia, Missouri. For the first time in the program history, the Panthers received an at-large bid into the NCAA softball tournament. UNI will make its third overall appearance in the NCAA's Friday when it plays in-state rival Iowa State, where the Cyclones and Panthers will join Missouri and Illinois-Chicago in a regional. ISU and UNI will play at 1 p.m. "This ties a bow on that promise," Jacob laughed. After losing 2-0 to Southern Illinois Saturday in the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament championship game, Jacob said he felt it was a 50-50 whether the Panthers would get into the tournament. With a nearly 9-hour bus ride back to Cedar Falls from Evansville, Indiana, Sunday, that left Jacobs a lot of time to check different message boards and looked at several different bracketology analysis. Some had with the Panthers in, some did not. Quote, "The first time we got in, UNI was the MVC champion in 2013. We knew we were in. This time we had no idea if we'd get in or not," Jacob said. "It is pure excitement and a joy to celebrate with these ladies. This moment was worth every hard-working day we went through this year. The berth caps off a year that, where Jacobs will admit he wasn't sure this trip to the NCAA tournament was possible. More than 85% of UNI's roster is made up of freshmen and sophomores. The fall was not kind to the Panthers. Then, after UNI's opening MVC conference series, UNI had a 9-11 record. But things started to click for the young players. Bunch and fellow seniors Adora Opiola and Hannah Kelly began pulling all the Panthers in the right direction. UNI finished 22-7 over the final month and a half of the season, earning the number 2 seed in the MVC tournament and seeing its RPI ranking improve to the lower 50s. Quote, "Absolutely no," Jacob said, if he could envision his team making the NCAA tournament in the fall. Quote, "I was that way halfway through the season. But something we talked about from day one is, let's win the MVC championship. That was our motivation. That was part of the process. I wasn't sure, but that was our goal and we worked toward it." Quote, "We got more and more buy-in every day. We surprised ourselves. We surprised a lot of people. So this was exciting. For players like Bunch and Opiola, who took advantage of an extra season of eligibility to play an extra year, it paid huge dividends. This is really exciting for me," Bunch said. "It is going to be really cool and fun experience for me and my family," unquote. Bunch said former Missouri coach Erin Earlywine recruited her lightly when she was a star at Fatima High School. Quote, "He did, but ironically, he told me I didn't hit enough home runs and stopped," laughed Bunch, who has hit 57 career home runs for UNI, including 21 this season. Quote, "I'm happy with my choice to come to UNI. I'm a small-town girl, and I don't know how it would have worked out at a big school," unquote. Opiola held off law school to play one more season. Quote, "It makes every decision so much easier, makes every reason so right," Opiola said, of holding off her future law career. "I just know all the hard work and sacrifices have been absolutely worth it. This will be an unbelievable experience." The Cyclones and Panthers have played twice this season and 83 times in history. ISU took the opening game 12-2 in the Unidome on February 12th, before the Panthers won 10-2 on April 14th at Robinson Dressier Sports Complex in Cedar Falls. ISU is making its first NCAA tournament appearance since 1988. Quote, "It is awesome for the state of Iowa to have two teams in the regionals," UNI sophomore pitcher Kayleen Packard said. "We've seen each other twice this season, so that makes it much more exciting." Quote, "I dreamed since I was a little girl of hearing my team's name called on Selection Sunday, so I can't even describe the feeling right now," unquote. UNI is a 6-30 against Missouri all time, with the last meeting coming in 2016. The Panthers are 8-3 overall against Illinois-Chicago, with the last meeting in 2013. "Some people will look at it as a silly first-round pairing," Jacob said. "To me, it is fitting. It's two fantastic programs, teams, and coaching staff. It will be fun. I have so much respect for Coach Pinkerton, his staff, and players. Quote, it is going to be a great experience to experience this together because it has been a long time since they've been there as well, unquote. In college track and field, Panthers claim MVC title. This is a staff report. Carbondale, Illinois. It was a three-peat Sunday for the Northern Iowa men's track and field team, with a final total of 167.5 points. The Panthers captured their third consecutive Missouri Valley Conference Outdoor Track and Field Championship. It is the 10th overall MVC outdoor title for UNI, as Panther head coach Dave Paulson was named Coach of the Year and Darius King was named Men's Most Outstanding Field Athlete. Sunday, UNI got wins from its 4x100 team of Michael Santi, Elijah Hicks, Dan Blocker, and Parker Hewitt. The Panther men also got victories from Thomas Yezek in discus. King was third. Isaiah Trussell took second in the 200 in 20.54. The UNI women finished fifth with 82 points. The Panthers saw senior Alina Mercusi win her second event of the weekend with a 13.65 clocking in the 100 hurdles. Taylor Raines took third in the 100 with 11.84 and 200 at 24 flat, and was the third leg in the UNI's runner-up team in the 4x100. Raylan Santee, Libby Wederer, Raines, and Patience Johnson posted a time of 45.31 to break a UNI program record that had stood for 27 years. On Saturday, UNI built a huge lead after 2 days in the team race thanks to several quality performances, including a 1-2-3-4 finish in the men's decathlon. Sophomore Zach Butcher won the event with 6,490 points. Freshman Carter Morton was second at 6,440. Sophomore Ty Thompson third at 6,369. And freshman Matt Davis fourth at 6,310. In the shot put, King won with a throw of 28.08 meters. Marcucci, on her sixth and final jump, won the women's long jump with a leap of 5.92 meters. Jack Sumners and Parker Hewitt went 2 and 3 in the men's long jump. Senior Cameron Cantrell took a second in the high jump, clearing 2.03 meters. In NASCAR, Bowman Hendrick team sizzle at Monster Mile, filed by Dave Gelston of the Associated Press, and begins with a photograph of the 48 car taking the checkered flag at Dover, Delaware. Moments after he smoked the field at Dover, Alex Bowman channeled fictional goofball NASCAR driver Ricky Bobby as flames simmered under the left rear of his Chevy. Quote, "Help me, Tom Cruise, I'm on fire," he said, quoting a popular line from Talladega Nights. At Hendrick Motorsports, if you ain't first, you're, well, at Dover it was second, third, and fourth. Bowman parked the number 48 Chevrolet in its familiar spot on Victory Lane at Dover International Speedway, leading a 1-2-3-4 finish for Hendrick Motorsports on Sunday. Bowman, who described himself as a race car driver slash weirdo, led Hendrick to only the fourth top four sweep by a single team in NASCAR Cup Series history. Kyle Larson led a race high 263 laps and finished second. Chase Elliott was third and William Byron fourth. The milestones kept coming at the Monster Mile. Hendrick Motorsports won its 267th career NASCAR race, one shy of the team record held by Petty Enterprises. Bowman, who added he's had my share of doubters throughout his career, won his second race of the season and passed 1,000 laps led in his career. But the victory celebration at the Monster Mile had to seem familiar for Hendrick Motorsports. Jimmy Johnson, the 7-time NASCAR champion, now in IndyCar, won a track record 11 times at Dover in the 48. Turns out Johnson's successor is just as adept at handling the rigors of the concrete mile track. Quote, I try to run the Jimmy Johnson line, Bowman said. Bowman also followed two of NASCAR's biggest superstars, first taking the wheel of the number 88 after Dale Earnhardt Jr. retired and made the move to the 48 this season. He's tried to escape their large shadows by doing things his way, though after early struggles in his career at Dover, he texted Johnson for tips that he followed to this day. Quote, you can't be Jimmy Johnson light, Hedrick said. You've got to be Alex Bowman. Bowman and crew chief Greg Ives put their spin into the game plan, and flawless pit road execution helped the 48 win this season for the first time since April at Richmond. Bowman joined Martin Truex Jr. as the only driver this season with multiple victories. Joey Logano of Joe Gibbs Racing was the best of the rest in the fifth. A year after fans were not allowed to attend, and Dover held two cup races on the same weekend, a sellout crowd of 20,000 fans was announced at the Monster Mile, and they were ready to bust loose. Going mostly maskless, though Miles the Monster wore his, fans formed a deep line at the Chase Elliott Souvenir Hauler inside the fan zone. Dover also partnered with the Delaware Division of Public Health, and about 100 fans received one-shot Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine on Sunday, and another 50 or so did the same a day earlier at the Xfinity race. They watched Larson lead a parade for all but a handful of laps into the third stage. Larson, who on Saturday made a virtual visit with students at the Urban Youth Racing School in Philadelphia, won the first two stages of the race and seemed poised to turn this race into a rout. Bowman spoiled the run when he beat the number 5 off pit road thanks to a 12-second stop and led the final 98 laps. One more reason why Hendrick is on the brink of signing the 28-year-old driver to a multi-year contract extension. Quote, I want to be there. They want me to drive their race cars, Bowman said. Who's hot? Hedrick Motorsports is the first team to finish 1, 2, 3, and 4 since Jack Roush in 2005. HMS led 382 of the 400 laps. Hedrick Motorsports has 267 victories, one shy of the NASCAR record held by Petty Enterprises. Petty Enterprises last competed in 2008. Who's not? Eric Almirola's woeful season continued at Dover when his number 10 Ford slammed into the wall with less than 100 laps left in the race. Almirola crashed out for the second straight week, and the Stuart Haas racing driver has only one top 10 finish in 2021. Quote, my body's hurting, Almirola said. It doesn't want to take any more hard hits like that, unquote. Dover and out. Dover wrapped up its only NASCAR weekend of the season. The track traditionally held two NASCAR weekends, but moved one race date to Nashville Super Speedway. Nashville will have a cup race on June 20th. The 1.33-mile concrete track was built in 2001 by Dover Motorsports and hosted NASCAR and IndyCar events until 2011. Nashville Super Speedway held Xfinity and truck events as well as IndyCar races from 2001 until 2011. Dover hosted one race weekend in 1969 and 1970, and then held two races every season from 1971 to 2020. Up next, NASCAR heads to Texas in the Circuit of Americas for a road course race. Sam Houston rallies in final minute to win FCS title. Filed by Stephen Hawkins of the Associated Press. Frisco, Texas. The way Sam Houston handled everything in the longest and most unusual college football season, Coach Casey Keeler felt it was fitting that the Bearcats got their first FCS national title with a last-minute touchdown after waiting out a lengthy weather delay. Eric Schmidt's third touchdown pass was a 10-yarder to Ife Adali with 16 seconds left, and Sam Houston, following two fourth-down conversions on that final drive, beat top-seeded South Dakota State 23-21 on a rain-drenched Sunday. Quote, it just showed such character by our kids. You're talking about the ultimate game, and you have to make one last drive, Keeler said. It's really a special group. When you consider this thing started in June, and we had no idea when this thing would ever end. You know, we decided not to play a fall season. It's been an emotional draining year, a physically draining year, unquote. Jaquez Azard caught 2 touchdowns for number 2 seed Houston, 10-0, after he had an early 63-yard punt return for a touchdown wiped out by an illegal block. His 5-yard catch on 4th and 3 extended the final 16-play, 65-yard drive after Schmidt's 9-yard run on an earlier 4th and 1. Keeler, in his 7th season at Sam Houston, got his record 24th FCS playoff victory and became the first coach to win FCS titles at multiple schools. He coached his alma mater, Delaware, in the 2003 title. South Dakota State, 8-2, led a 21-17 on freshman Isaiah Davis's 3rd touchdown run, an 85-yarder with 5.41 seconds left. Davis, who finished with 178 yards rushing on 14 carries, went down the sideline in front of the Jackrabbits bench, eluding half of the defense before breaking free to the end zone. Quote, we were this close, Davis said. We watched them celebrate, raise the trophy up, and we know what it takes. You know, 170-something practices, and came up short one play. It was the first title game appearance for South Dakota State coach and John Steigelmeier, who has coached his alma mater for 24 seasons. The Jackrabbits lost dual-threat freshman quarterback Mark Gronowski to a left leg injury on the opening series of the game. Quote, we didn't have to play in the spring. We got to play in the spring. We embraced it, unquote. Steigelmeier said, quote, how should our fans remember this team? They should remember a bunch of guys that bonded together and gave everything they had, unquote. Azard had 69-yard touchdown catch and an 80-yard punt return for a score when the Bearcats overcame a 21-point halftime deficit in a 38-35 win in the semifinals against number 3 seed James Madison, the only team other than 8-time champion North Dakota State to win the FCF title in the past 9 seasons. Sam Houston in the quarterfinal round eliminated the Bison, who won the title the last 3 years. Azard, who had 10 catches for 108 yards, put the Bearcats up 14-7 with his 15-yard touchdown when he was wide open in the end zone. That occurred shortly after the game resumed, following a 74-minute delay because of lightning. The halftime break was shortened to 3 minutes. It wasn't a shocker for us because we've dealt with stuff like that all year, said Schmidt, who finished 20 of 37 passing for a 209 yards. We were kind of joking in the locker room, like it's got to be this way for us to win, unquote. Before the stoppage, Azard had a tying 35-yard touchdown when he made the catch behind the line near the left sideline, then cut back and broke a tackle before scoring near the right corner of the end zone. The weather delay came in the final game of a season pushed into the spring and ended in mid-May instead of January because of the coronavirus pandemic. Next season kicks off in only 3.5 months. The game started in a steady rain before getting stopped with 8 minutes 25 left in the second quarter because of lightning from the same weather system that impacted the final round of the PGA Tour's AT&T Byron Nelson tournament in McKinney, Texas, less than 10 miles away. There were tornado warnings south of the area. The rain had stopped when play resumed, and the sun even broke through the clouds. Smid couldn't handle a high snap on Sam Houston's opening drive, and it was recovered by Tulu Ogunrindi at Bearcats 41. That led to a 1-yard score by Davis, who, early in the fourth quarter, broke 3 tackles on a 28-yard touchdown. The sailors go one and one at Waverly Shell Rock. Waverly. Waterloo Columbus went one-on-one Saturday at the Waverly Shell Rock Girls Soccer Invitational. The Sailors scored first against 14th-ranked Bondurant Ferrara, but the Blue Jays scored the final four goals for a 4-1 win. Adriana Galen had Columbus's goal. In the second game, Reagan Lindsay set up Galen for an early goal as the Sailors rolled past Independence 4-1 to improve to 12-2 overall. McKenna Youngbolt also scored, and Nikayla Youngbolt had two goals. Cameron Ortiz, Kayla Cook, and McKenna Youngblood all had assists in that game. The Sailors will host 11th-ranked Dyke New Hartford Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. In boys' tennis, the Tigers advance. Cedar Falls won the final five singles matches to top Cedar Rapids, Washington, in a 2A regional tennis meet Saturday. Pranav Chandra, Param Sampat, Vikash Prithivi Ayyappan, Sai Pranav Kota, and Anurag Anuggu all claimed singles wins. Pranav Kota blanked Colton Ayers at number 5, 6-0, 6-0. The Tigers will play at Cedar Rapids Kennedy Saturday against Pleasant Valley in a regional semifinal. Mason City and Dubuque Senior will play in the other semifinal. In college volleyball, former Hudson star Kara Klunder named NAIA Freshman of the Year. And this is a staff report, and it opens with a photograph of Sarah Klunder, St. Louis, Missouri. Former Hudson standout Sarah Klunder has been named the American Volleyball Coaches Association National Freshman of the Year for NAIA. Klunder, who was also named a third-team NAIA All-American, helped lead the Spartans to the NAIA National Championship. The 6'3" Klunder hit 379 for the season with 189 kills, 57 blocks, and 14 service aces. In the national championships, Klunder had 11 kills against Kaiser University, 12 against Dort, and 8 in a win over Milligan of Tennessee. In addition to her national honors, Klunder was the American Midwest Conference Freshman of the Year, First Team All-Conference selection, and the AVCA All-Midwest Regional Freshman of the Year. Missouri Baptist is located in St. Louis, Missouri. In the Around the NBA column, play-ins, other series take shape. The NBA's new play-in tournament begins Tuesday night, and it took until the 146th and final day of this compressed season to determine who is going where for the playoffs. The Eastern Conference matchups, number 7 Boston will host number 8 Washington, and number 9 Indiana will host number 10 Charlotte in the first elimination game. Both of those games are Tuesday. And the Western Conference, the 7th-seeded Lakers and LeBron James hosting number 8 Golden State, and Stephen Curry, along with number 9 Memphis, playing host to number 10 San Antonio. Those two matchups are Wednesday. The Boston-Washington winner goes straight to the playoffs, as the East's number 7 seed will play number 2 Brooklyn. The loser will host the Indiana-Charlotte winner on Thursday to determine the number 8 seed, who will face top-seeded Philadelphia. Same deal out west. The Lakers-Warriors winner is the number 7 seed and will play Phoenix. The loser there will play host to the Memphis-San Antonio winner for the right to play the top-seeded Utah Jazz. Other West first-round matchups are number 3 Denver versus number 6 Portland and number 5 Dallas versus number 4 Los Angeles Clippers. Curry wins his second scoring title, San Francisco, by making a floater with 3.43 to go in the first quarter of Sunday's game against Memphis Grizzlies. Warrior guard Stephen Curry won the second scoring title of his career. Curry, the 19th player in NBA history to win multiple scoring titles, needed just 3 points to earn the scoring title over Washington Wizards guard Bradley Beal. In Sunday's NBA games, Blazers defeat Nuggets, knock Lakers into the play-in round, filed by the Associated Press. Portland, Oregon. Damian Lillard had 22 points and 10 assists and the Portland Trail Blazers beat the Denver Nuggets 132-116 in the regular season finale Sunday night to secure their eighth straight playoff berth, the longest active streak in the NBA. The Blazers secured the sixth seed, which means they'll face the Nuggets in the opening round. Denver was assured of the number three seed when the Clippers fell to the Thunder. Lakers 110, Pelicans 98. Portland's win made Los Angeles' victory in New Orleans meaningless as the number seven seed Lakers head to the play-in round to face Golden State. LeBron James scored 25 points before he appeared to mildly aggravate a right ankle injury. Warriors 113, Grizzlies 101. Stephen Curry scored 46 points, including 33 in the second half, in a home victory over Memphis that clinched the number 8 seed in the play-in tournament. Jazz 121, Kings 99. Jordan Clarkson scored 33 points. Rudy Gobert added 13 points and 16 rebounds, and Utah took the number 1 overall seed with a win in Sacramento. Suns 123, Spurs 121. Yutuan Moore scored 22 points, and Phoenix won in San Antonio. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, May 17th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.